All right, welcome to Wesley's Own Words, where we are going back to look at some of the original writings of John Wesley and the ones that are sort of quintessential to making Methodists Methodists. And in this part of the series, we are looking at John Wesley's General Rules of Our United Societies, which is a very early writing in the first few years of the Methodist movement being the Methodist movement, and before we were even commonly known as Methodists. When you say United Societies, that's what we mean. Last time we looked at not verses, because this is not scripture, let's be clear, paragraphs 1 through 3, which are really kind of an introduction to the whole thing. So if you haven't listened to that one, go back and listen to the first episode of this podcast. But today we're going to look at chapter 4, 5 and a half of paragraph. I'll get that right by the end. 6, where we start to get into the real meat of the matter. So we've talked last time about how the church, how the movement was structured as basically a series of small groups. And then Wesley kind of transitions into really the bulk of the text, which is about, again, what makes us us. And here he kind of leaves behind the technical distinctions about, you know, how we're going to gather in these class meeting structure, but more leads into the why. So, you know, before the famous Simon Sinek TED talk on the importance of knowing your why, Wesley was already well tuned into that, and we see here some evidence of that. Now, so in paragraph 4, he says, there is only one condition previously required of those who desire admission into these societies, a desire to flee from the wrath to come and to be saved from their sins. But wherever this is really fixed in the soul, it will be shown by its fruit. So part of that is in quotes. The part about fleeing the wrath and saved from sins is in quotes. And he's really quoting himself earlier back in chapter 1. That language was his. And we dug into that fleeing the wrath to come last time. So just as a way of summarizing. Oh my gosh, I am on fire today with the made-up words. Summarizing. You know, he's saying people who are struggling or desiring to be accountable, right? So to flee from the wrath to come and to be saved from their sins recognizes that there's something in our lives that is not as it should be. And we want some help and some accountability about living better, about living more in the way that God wants to live, live more in the way following in the pattern and example of Christ. I mean, that's kind of the nicer way to put it. He uses some wonderfully stark 17th century language, you know, as he is wont to do, and that's fine. He's allowed. You know, so that's why people, you know, what the only real condition for being part of the United Societies is a desire to support and help each other through, you know, overcoming the difficult and parts of our lives and overcoming the struggles that many, if not all of us, face. So as long as you're willing to want to yourself become more than you are today, and you're willing to help others themselves become more and live more like the beloved children of God that they are, then you're welcome. I mean, that's it. That's the litmus test. Like, if you're willing to do that. And then he says, where this is true, you know, where it is true that you are one of those people, is that there'll still be some fruitfulness in your lives, right? That you can say all you want, oh yeah, I want to be quote unquote saved from my sins, or I want to live better, or I want to live more like Jesus, or I want to be a better person, or whatever that is. Like, that's all great. Like, anybody can say that. But if you really mean it, then there should be some sort of fruitfulness, something in your life that is different or transformed or changed, that demonstrates that desire inside of you is really there. And that is true. And so then he goes on. So that's paragraph 4. And then he goes on immediately in 5 and says, it is therefore expected. It's a connecting phrase. It is therefore. Everything above, you know, it is therefore connected or expected that if you really do, you know, want to live more like Christ, if you really want to be part of this society, if you really want to be part of a community striving to live in a different and presumably better way, It is therefore expected of all who continue therein that they should continue to evidence their desire of salvation. There should be evidence of our desire for salvation, is how Wesley phrases it. And basically he said, people, you should be able to look around your life and others should be able to look at your life and say, there is some evidence here of you trying to live and be better. There should be some evidence of it. So then he goes on, and that's paragraph five. So we've gone through four and five, and we're only doing half of six. This is going to be the shortest podcast ever. Nope. Six is a little long. All right. Six paragraphs. They should continue to evidence their desire of salvation first, colon, by doing no harm, by avoiding evil of every kind, especially that which is most generally practiced, such as. So the first thing we're going to do is to do no harm. Not the first thing to do is to do good. Not the first thing to do anything else. The first thing we should do is do what we can to avoid making things worse for ourselves and others. I love that Wesley starts here. I love that he recognizes that when we feel like maybe we are stuck at the bottom of the hole, the first thing we need to do is stop digging and making it deeper, right? So step one, before you do anything else, look around. Am I doing my harm to myself or harm to others? Am I doing that on a regular basis? And how can I stop? So harm reduction is number one. And harm reduction when it comes to things like addiction and all kinds of stuff is a hot button topic, right? Like, you know, like needle exchanges are that, right? Like at a certain point you recognize people are going to use drugs whether you give them needles or not. So, you know, shouldn't they at least be doing it with clean needles so they don't like hurt themselves and give themselves, you know, transferable diseases? That is harm reduction. That is a line of thinking that is in line with this idea of harm reduction. That, you know, what, you know, and Wesley starts with first, make sure you are not doing harm to yourself or others. And if there are places that you are, then you need to reduce or eliminate the harm that you are doing. And if you look, and if you are living in a way where you are actively trying to eliminate or reduce the harm you are doing, that is part of how you will evidence your desire for salvation. And then he goes on to say that which is most generally practiced, right? So he's going to give a list, and the list he's giving, he's basically saying, I'm just giving you the things that I see as harmful that appear to be generally practiced at this time. So at the time Wesley is living, you know, in the 1700s. So in the 1700s, these are activities that he feels are harmful to people themselves or to others, that are generally practiced, basically widely practiced. You know, and so like on this list, and we talked about this in class when we were talking about this class, is like on this list is not murder. Right? Murder and adultery and, you know, those kinds of things actually aren't on the list. And it's not that Wesley doesn't think those are harmful. He just doesn't think they are generally practiced. And, or he recognizes that we almost universally recognize them as such, right? Like nobody should have to tell you that murder is bad and murder harms, right? Both, you know, very much the one being murdered, but then arguably does harm to the murderer and their soul as well. So, Wesley's not given that list. This isn't the Ten Commandments necessarily because, you know, that a lot of those are well known. Like you already know, and you don't really need somebody to tell you not to murder your neighbor, right? That's harmful. But instead, he's going through this list of things that he feels are generally practiced and in many ways generally accepted, but are still harmful practices that we maybe need to think about or probably need to avoid. So the generally practiced harms he talks about, first, taking the name of God in vain. Well, that does sound like one of the commandments, right? And this is, you know, and I'm sure the time Wesley is living in, the time that, you know, we live in today, that there are plenty of people you find who are, quote unquote, taking the Lord's name in vain. Sometimes we take that to mean profanity, using the God's name in a profane way, you know, God dang it, you know, or something worse, usually, than that. And that's probably, you know, what he means as well. But also just really anything that belittles or despairs disparages the idea of God and God's love and God's place in the universe. Wesley, I have no doubt, was what he's saying when he says God's name in vain. And the problem is what it does is it can erode our belief in God. Like that, how does that do harm? Like how does it, is God harmed by us taking his name in vain? Does God care? Is it possible for us as mere mortals to harm God? Well, that's a whole other conversation, but it can do harm to our faith, right? If we get into the practice of belittling or using, you know, God in, you know, trifling or, you know, unhelpful ways, that can actually affect our faith. It can affect the faith of our friends and our loved ones. You know, if they see people continually making fun, or, you know, whatever that is, something like that of this thing that they care about and is valuable. So really we should treat God in a respectful way, in the same way we were called to respect our parents and, you know, everyone else. So he's like, that's step one, like, you know, make sure you understand and are not, you know, misusing God's name, but also the idea of God and the existence of God in a way that doesn't actually help you or others. And then he goes on into the next one that actually also does also sound like a commandment, even though I said these weren't the commandments. The profaning of the day of the Lord, either by doing ordinary work therein or buying or selling. So basically take the Sabbath and keep it holy. Take a day off. Take a day of rest. Take a day to reconnect with God and yourself and your neighbors and your family. You know, don't work all of the time. And by avoiding buying and selling, we are also not forcing, we are also not participating in a system that requires other people to never take a day off. Now, we in the United States have moved beyond this. Like, you know, everything's open on Sundays now. That didn't used to be the way it was. There didn't used to be kids games, you know, sports games and all that kind of stuff, you know, scheduled on Sundays. And a lot of the stores didn't used to be open. And that's true. And that's not the world we live in today. And no amount of complaining is going to make us go back. What I think is funny is there are still countries that live this way. I'm fairly certain, like in Switzerland, and I believe in Germany as well, you know, stores are not open on normal everyday stores are not open on Sundays. You know, you only have to, it's only a very, very small number. And of course, there's always a small number of people who always have to work because the hospitals are open and the hotels are open and the gas stations are open and things like that. But, you know, you're not shopping for extraneous things, and that, those things are not open, even though those are very unreligious countries, right? I mean, there are some places that still have some fairly strong traditions around what you can and can't do on a Sunday. In Germany, I believe even like mowing your lawn, you know, even though that's a personal thing, you know, mowing your lawn on a Sunday, you know, you're this is not okay because you are, you know, really supposed to be, you're interfering with somebody else's enjoyment of the day, right? By running your noisy lawnmower. Yeah, but, you know, taking that time, making sure you are taking regularly intentional time for Sabbath, intentional time, yes, for rest, that's a big part of it, but also intentional time for connection and reconnection, reconnection with the holy, reconnection with your family, reconnection with your friends, you know, that by honoring the Sabbath and not profaning the day of the Lord by doing work, basically saying, you know, you, God, want to give me this gift of rest and connection, but instead I'm just not going to do it, right? It's like, instead I got better things to do. I'm going to go over here and make a little extra money, right? I don't need your rest. I don't need your connection. I don't need any of that, right? That's why he talks about in terms of profaning, right? That somebody, God, is giving us this gift through the instruction to rest and rehabilitate ourselves and our souls on a regular basis. And we're basically saying, nah, I got better things to do. I got some work to do over here. I'd rather be doing that. Wesley says, don't do that. Second, and then the next thing he lists is drunkenness, buying or selling of spirituous liquors or drinking them, unless in cases of extreme necessity. Extremely necessary drunkenness, which is kind of a funny idea. First of all, he's taking a very expanded view of drunkenness on this one. I mean, yes, the the, you know, habit or condition of having imbibed too much, you know, alcohol being in an impaired and inebriated state, what we would normally think about when we think of somebody as being drunk. You know, yes, obviously that's you know, something he's saying no to. But more than just that, it's more than just that. It's also the buying and selling of spirituous liquors. You know, in Wesley's day, there was writing, and there was a lot of opinions and stuff offered up around the problem of gin. And there are writings of the time where gin is described in the same way that, like, crack cocaine was in the 80s and the 90s, and that fentanyl is today. It was this cheap, ubiquitous, easy to access, you know, mind-altering substance that was proliferating amongst the poor and the working poor, and wrecking, you know, untold damage to family and individuals and society in general. Right? Like, we've gone through this before. And, you know, while I think of gin as like that kind of high-minded thing you make weird cocktails out of with the gut, funnily tastes of flowers or, you know, whatever. You know, that was one of the biggest concerns at the time. And so, you know, John Wesley's first and foremost, you know, not only should you not be consuming it, you know, in excess, you really shouldn't be involved in its, you know, production or sale, like profiting off of it, because so much of it is being used and it is visiting so much problems on so many people that you don't even want to participate in that system of doing it. So it's not just you individually, you know, going out and having too many and getting drunk. That is a problem, but it's not the only problem. It's also the buying and selling of spirituous liquors, participating in a system that is harming people, right? And especially profiting off of the harm of others. Oh my gosh. I mean, you probably don't get worse than that as far as John is concerned. And the idea of unless in cases of extreme necessity, because at the time, you know, medicine and healthcare was not what it is today. They didn't have a lot of options. There was no Advil. There was no, you know, there were no sedatives. There was no way to knock somebody out for surgery. So if you had to get a tooth out, you know, because, you know, you had a rotten tooth, which happened a lot, it was not uncommon to say, okay, well, drink a fifth of gin and then come in and we'll take it out and maybe you'll feel less. And this was kind of the state of things for another like 100 years. I mean, that was the best thing you got. So he wasn't saying don't deny yourself something you need if you need it. Thus the, you know, except in cases of extreme necessity, that there may be times of necessity, but that's the kind of necessity he's talking about. Not like, oh, my friends are, you know, daring me to do a keg stand and thus it's necessary that I do it, or I'm at a friend's party and everybody else is drinking, so it's necessary that I do it. That's not what he's saying. He's saying in kind of a healthcare clinical kind of sense, because that's what they have at the time. But I think it's more interesting to say that, you know, spirituous liquors, you know, he saw as a scourge at the time, no doubt, as many people did, and kind of a blight on society. And while certainly there was plenty of money to be made buying and selling them, don't do it. Don't participate in that system. Goes on to say slaveholding, buying or selling slaves. Now, slavery in England was not, was legal, but it wasn't popular because honestly, England had a sufficient population. They had enough people. And they certainly had a lot of poor people. They had a lot of people who were willing to do hard work on the land. All those jobs we brought the slaves over into the United States to do, they had people to do because they had been basically, you know, they'd had an underclass for a long time. They didn't need to import more. So it's not really out of any kind of high-mindedism that, you know, they were, you know, that they didn't have a lot of widespread slavery in England itself, even though it was legal there. It was that they already had plenty of people they were exploiting. Right, there's already plenty of exploitation happening, so they didn't really need to import more. But slavery was legal, so you would occasionally run into people who held slaves themselves, and John would have a problem with that. This is being written after John's rather disastrous trip to be a missionary in Georgia, but one of the things he did see while he was a missionary in Georgia is the reality of slavery and what those conditions looked like and how hard they were. So, Pardon me. But, you know, so he does and will be his entire life a committed abolitionist. So he doesn't want people participating in that, even though it's not likely that they would. But again, he also doesn't want them participating in it financially. He doesn't want them profiting on it, because while the UK itself was not a destination for slaves, it very much was involved in the slave trade, in that a lot of British-owned ships from British companies with British captains sailed from Africa loaded down with slaves to America, and then sailed home, usually with cotton or some other goods from America, back home to the United Kingdom or to England, so that they could, you know, and they would profit, you know, off of that. And so, you know, John would say, don't profit off the exploitation of others. Like, you cannot claim that you are trying to do less or no harm if you're profiting from something that is harming other people. So he says no slaveholding, no buying or selling of slaves. And then we get fighting, quarreling, brawling, brother going to law with brother, returning evil for evil, rallying for rallying, the using of many words and buying of selling. That is all one sentence. And he's really talking about escalating, right? Like fighting, quarreling, brawling, right? Brother going to law against brother, right? All those ways that we not only like disagree, like John isn't against disagreement. He will disagree with lots of people. He's really against fighting, right? Arguing in such a way that you are intending through your argument or intending through your quarreling to do harm to one another, right? Because if you're fighting with somebody, whether verbally or physically, you are intending to do harm to them, right? And so if you are fighting, quarreling, or brawling, then you are intending to do harm to another person. And thus you cannot be living a life of reduced or no harm, because that is literally what you are trying to do. Brother going to law against brother. You are trying to use the law to harm somebody else. Come to agreement on your own that you can just settle before you even get to the courthouse steps. No doubt would have been John's thing. And then returning evil for evil, railing for railing, right? If somebody is mean to you or bad to you or does something awful to you, your goal should not be to just, okay, now I can do something awful back to you. If somebody is railing, right? Like what's the way somebody railing? If somebody's in your face yelling and screaming, right? What good does it going to do to scream back? Are they going to stop? Are they going to de-escalate, or is it just going to start a terrible spiral and it's just all going to get worse, right? John doesn't want us to even get ourselves involved in these spirals down where things just continue to escalate and continue to get worse and continue to get worse, because eventually harm will be done throughout that entire process. And eventually you get to the point where it's possible that real lasting harm that cannot be taken back can be done. Doesn't want us to do that. So, you know, not going down that hole, you know, going down that, again, that spiral downward. And then using many words in buying or selling. It's a little before, you know, we'd start seeing the coin of the turn snake oil salesman. But there's something about that, right? There's the, like, you know, trying to pull one over on somebody, or, you know, convince somebody to buy something they don't actually need, or, you know, whatever. So much of the economy was informal at this time. You'd go to the market, you'd buy what you wanted there. You know, people went, you know, street to street, you know, selling what they had. So if you think about kind of the classic sleazy used car salesman that's got a contract 6 feet thick that basically explains why they're not responsible for anything, you know, that's kind of the idea of the using many words, right? Basically try to like either overwhelm or pull one over or whatever on somebody else. He's like, no, don't do that. And then the final one, we're only halfway through the list. We'll pick up the other half next time. But the final one we talk about today is the buying and selling of goods that have not been paid the duty. this was a time before income tax was a thing. And the primary way that people would pay tax is through duty, right? So either, you know, the tax that somebody pays when they import something into the country that then gets sold, or the tax they pay when they export something, or the tax they pay when they manufacture something. And all this stuff would be stamped, right? Like that's how you would know. So you would buy something, you know, especially any kind of like package thing, and it would have a stamp on it, you know, and, or, you know, a barrel of something. You might buy a barrel of wine, or, you know, a barrel of wheat, you know, or whatever. If it had been properly taxed and paid the taxes paid, then the tax collector, who would have literally looked at the barrel and go, okay, you owe me, you know, whatever. And then he would stamp it. And that's how you know that the tax was getting paid. And so some unscrupulous people would basically find a way to work their products around the tax collector, either, you know, unloading them at a different dock by night when they're not around, or, you know, whatever. And that those goods would, of course, be cheaper because the person selling it isn't trying to recoup the tax money that they paid. So there's a benefit there. But it also means you're not paying your taxes. You're not meeting your responsibility as a citizen of the country. And you're inviting, you know, potential harm on yourself if you get found out. And so, you know, John was like, says, no, don't do that. Like, you know, be a responsible citizen. Meet the expectations that are set for you. Yeah, so don't do that. All right. So this is the beginning of the list of do no harm. And you can see it's all very practical stuff. And many of it still applies today. Like I said, we don't have the same strictness around the Sabbath anymore, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't have some strictness around a regular intentional time of rest and connection with God. This expanded definition of drunkenness. You know, are you participating in something that's doing harm to others? You know, I mean, you know, if you're involved in the fentanyl business, maybe rethink that. Maybe that's not the best choice for you or anybody. 'Cause that certainly, you know, is true. Slaveholding, you know, how we all sometimes participate in systems where people are being exploited, whether we know it or not. You know, even if we're not the ones doing the exploiting, you know, if we are profiting from or getting some kind of advantage from people being exploited, right? I mean, if the cost of that really cheap food or whatever it might be is that people have to be exploited, held in almost slave-like conditions to grow and cultivate the food, well, then that's not okay. Like, that's a problem. And then finally, fighting, quarreling, brawling, you know, doing things that are designed to harm someone else. If we are intentionally harming people, we cannot be avoiding or reducing harm the way that God wants us to. So first, do no harm. And so next week we'll catch up on the second half of the list and other places that John wants us to avoid harm. I hope this has been interesting to you. It's interesting to me. I love going through this stuff. It is such fun. And they're still amazing to me how relevant these words are. I suppose I'm less surprised that scripture is still relevant, so relevant still today, even though it's 2,000 years old. But this really was John's just letter to a friend, and yet today it's, maybe not just a letter to a friend, a little more than that, but it's still meaningful and informative for us. So let us go from this week and do what we can to reduce or completely eliminate the harm we may be doing to ourselves and others. And no, if we do that, then we are honoring Wesley and what he called us as Methodists to do. Great. All right. Well, thanks for joining us in this one. We'll see you again next week, and have a blessed day.